Blog Talk Radio.
To a great Thursday night here with me on the cover. I am one of your co-hosts, John Robb. Of course, we are back with our wonderful co-host, Jeff Ayers. Jeff, how you doing?
Feeling much better and had a great vacation, and it's great to be back. And sorry
yeah.
you are dealing with wildfires and power issues.
Yeah, that's why we were off Tuesday, because I had a loss of power, and when there's no power, there's no internet, there's no studio, there's no shit that happens. So that's why we moved the show here to Thursday, and thank God that John was able to accommodate us, because we are great that we're able to have John land on talking about the latest Murder, She Wrote book, 49 or 48 in the series called Manuscript for Murder. So that's going to be great to talk to him. We're going to have him for the entire hour. Because it's always great conversations with John. Want to remind everybody, though, that all of our shows are brought to you by Kensington Books, so please make sure you visit kensingtonbooks.com for more information on all of their stuff. So let's just, without any further ado, Jeff, you ready?
Oh, absolutely. Looking forward to this.
All right, so here we go. Again, the book is called Manuscript for Murder. It is the latest in the Murder, She Wrote novel series, authored by John Land. This is his second. The last one was A Date with Murder. So, John, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Thank you very much, and this is number 48 overall. You're right, it's my second. But let's make sure we break some news tonight and talk about number 50.
Number 50, wait a second, you're skipping 49.
Wow, we could talk about 49 also, but 50 is special. I haven't started it yet, but, you know, I always like to come on and give you something I haven't told anybody else yet. So that's
nice.
Important.
So,
and in fact, if we get around to... Well, we can break some Thriller Fest news too. We got a big guest in last night. Someone we've been trying to get for a while, who's a friend of mine who doesn't do conferences, but he is doing Thriller Fest, so we can talk about that too. How about that for some teases to keep people listening for the next hour?
Nice.
I love it.
We're gonna be at Thriller Fest this time. So awesome.
And you're gonna be pleased when I break this news later on to keep people listening for the second half hour.
Okay.
Well, so you're going to tease us for the whole hour. Thanks.
Yeah,
well,
of course. You know,
I'm just waiting for you to ask me the question. I just answer the questions, so as soon as you ask me, you get the answer.
Okay.
So who is
so
the author that's coming?
Stephen Hunter is going to be joining us at Thriller Fest this year.
Who?
The author of the Bob Lee Swagger novels, Shooter, a TV show on USA, horribly miscast, unfortunately, with Ryan Phillippe as
right.
Swagger, but what are you going to do? Harry Dean Stanton isn't alive anymore, so we can't cast him as Swagger. But I think he is the – when you talk about action thrillers, which is what, you know, pioneered by David Morrell, mastered by Lee Child, nobody writes – and this is a quote from the professor, David Morrell himself – nobody writes gunfights like Stephen Hunter. You know, nobody.
Yeah.
He is the best gunfighter novelist, and Swagger is one of the most – right there with Reacher – when it comes to iconic thriller heroes of the late 20th and early 21st century. He's a wonderful guy, and he's got so many, some great experiences as a film critic with the Baltimore. So we're just real excited that we had this opportunity. And
my favorite book of his is Not a Swagger.
Which one is it?
The Day After Midnight.
Oh, that's the first one I read by him.
Yeah.
Terrific book. It was followed by Point of Impact.
Right.
It's always great. John, the thing I love about coming on the show is I love talking about thrillers. I love the genre.
Yeah.
Movies, books, pretty much anything. So to come on here and not just talk about me, but to talk about, you know, the genre that I'm lucky enough to be a part of,
mm-hmm.
it's really a great treat, because I don't get that opportunity very often. But things don't happen in a vacuum. You know, you're part of something bigger, and, you know, the thriller fan base is so huge, the mystery fan base so huge. It's nice that even though we're in competition, we get along really well. You know, we have a wonderful community of writers, thanks to International
yep.
Thriller Writers.
Yeah.
You know it. You'll be. You know, Jeff knows it. You know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he's a tri-chair of our Career Fest, in the pre-days before Thriller Fest. So, it's a special relationship, both writers with other writers, but especially what I pride myself on, my relationship with my readers, which is to me very crucial.
Well, let's just jump right into it then, and let's get into the latest book, Manuscript for Murder, because, you know, it's one of those books that I guess you want to say, you know, this is a different kind of Murder, She Wrote. If you're looking for the same kind of Jessica, you're going to find a little bit more thrills. You're going to find a little different. That's kind of what I wrote when I, you know, when I reviewed it and
yes.
I put it in there. I said, this is a different Jessica kind of than what you're used to. So give us a little bit about Manuscript for Murder, kind of your thought process and what you're going for.
Well, in general, let me answer that question in the micro and the macro. In the more general sense, in the macro, my goal as a writer, whatever I'm writing, and if it's a book review, if it's an essay, if it's a blog, if it's a thriller, if it's a mystery, I have many goals, but one primary goal, and that is to keep you reading, to keep you turning the pages, to keep you in suspense. That suspense is defined differently depending on the medium that I'm writing in or the genre that I'm writing. But the concept stays the same. So when I took over the Murder, She Wrote series, there's an instinctive nature to my writing that propels, if the word is propulsion. My stories are always moving forward. To be frank, the series that I inherited from Don Bain was extremely well written. But the last three or four or five in the series did not focus as much on the mystery as the minutia. The pace was just not the way I'm not saying these weren't great books. They weren't but they weren't the kind of book that I can write. You'd never want to start, especially even if you're taking over a series, you never want to start by trying to imitate what was already done. You know, Roger Moore didn't try to imitate Sean Connery when he took over the James Bond series. It's the same thing as a writer. You have to be true to yourself or you will end up with something that is unreadable. So when I took over the series, I brought not a conscious desire to change the definition of the cozy. I brought my instincts and desire to tell a great story. In the micro, in the case of Manuscript for Murder, after Don Bain, who I was working with, passed away, I worked a lot with his grandson, and I continue to work with Zach. And Zach is a great sounding board. And what I arrived at with Zach, or what I now tell people, is I'm writing this series. I wrote Manuscript for Murder, which was my first solo effort, as you make note of in your review. I wrote Manuscript for Murder as if it was Jessica Fletcher being introduced in 2018. I'm not trying to write these series as if it's still 1985, 1984, when the television show debuted. The other thing I'm consciously doing is, and I am going back to the mythology and lexicon of the television series. For example, Artie Gelber, the New York detective who appeared, played by Herb Edelman, a dozen episodes of the series, never appears in any of the books.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't appear in any of the books, but he is a big character. The librarian, Jean O'Neill, the next book, number 49, opens with her funeral. We can talk a little bit more about that character and how she ended up in the series later. But Jean O'Neill was strictly a character in the television show, just like Artie
yeah.
Gelber. Harry McGraw was in both, and Harry is a crucial. So, of course, was Mort Metzger and Seth. So, in speaking with Zach, Don Bain's grandson, both of us were big fans of the movie The Ghost Rider, directed by the great Roman Polanski. You know, his personal life aside, he is a brilliant film director. Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, the list goes on.
Yeah.
The concept of The Ghost Rider was a ghost writer who replaces a writer who passed away before finishing a biography of a famous politician, and comes to realize that his predecessor was murdered because of something he discovered in the course of his research. So with Manuscript for Murder, I kind of combined that notion with the notion, metaphorically, of Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose, which is literally about a book that kills, literally. Well, figuratively, in Manuscript for Murder, there is a manuscript, an unpublished book that Jessica Fletcher's publisher pays a tremendous amount of money for in the hopes that he has discovered the next Da Vinci Code. Mm-hmm. And anyone, there's only one copy of this manuscript left, and he gives it to Jessica to get her thoughts on it. And then everyone who has seen or read or in possession of the manuscript begins to die. Suicides, accidents. We know they're not suicides and accidents. So the idea is Jessica must uncover what it is about this manuscript written by an author no one's ever heard of and she can't track down. What is it about this manuscript that makes everyone who reads it a target for murder? What makes, now that's a mystery. What I've done instinctively is, since Jessica has the manuscript, since Jessica is reading the manuscript, Jessica's life is also threatened. So this is this is something that's different, as you've noted, that this is the primary difference between Murder, She Wrote, the first 46 books, and Murder, She Wrote Now. Jessica's life was endangered in a date with murder, and now it's she, because here's, and this is the reason why the thriller form to me is more natural than the mystery form, is that the thriller form, the hero is not out to do something out because it's their job or it's just fun. The hero is out for something to help someone else. Jessica in Manuscript for Murder wants to find out who killed someone who was her third publisher. Thank you, Jeff, for that note, by the way. She is trying to find out who killed a man who was very important to her, a man who she was very close to. It's about justice. It's not about vengeance. But the difference is the true hero pursues justice, goes on a quest to save something bigger than himself, but they also do it at the risk of their own safety, the risk of their own life. That's where the cozy thriller, to coin the phrase used by BookTrib in their review of the book, the cozy thriller. So all the ingredients that people love about the Murder, She Wrote series, the recurring cast, the setting of Cabot Cove, the dialogue, the banter, the structure of the mystery, all that's still there. All I've done is added some new wrinkles, which I don't think are as dramatic as some of the people who have commented about this book in particular feel. I don't think I reinvented the wheel. I think I pumped more air in and made it spin a little faster. And that's up to individual readers to determine whether the series is still for them or not. But hopefully it will be discovered by more fans of the television show, which it resembles a little more. And hopefully also it will be discovered by more murder fans who are big fans of Agatha Christie, Miss Marple, Hercule Poirot, because I think it resembles those books a little more now. I think it resembles even a little more of Michael Connelly in some respects when you look at what he does with Harry Bosch. So there is a, again, this is Jessica 2018. This is Jessica with a cell phone. This is Jessica who is aware of the world around her, living in a Cabot Cove that is under siege during the summer by tourists and people, the summer people who are coming there, and they increase the tax base. But boy, they clog up the roads, and we make note of that. I make note of that, the changes.
Well, let me talk to you a bit about the reviews, because the reviews that you're seeing primarily are...
Man, Jeff just jumped right in the freaking pond, doesn't he?
Well, you brought it up, so I have to ask.
Go ahead.
The biggest concern I see in the reviews tends to be about her voice. Could you talk a bit about that? you know, you talked about updating her for 2018.
You know, that's a great question, and that's a great question. I found Jessica's voice by channeling a little Angela Lansbury. Now, I think that this is more Angela Lansbury, in the sense that I think the TV show is a little edgier than the latter entries in the book series. The TV show dealt with issues that were a little more contemporary, and it was also paced like a TV show, so there was a cliffhanger every 8 minutes or 9 minutes or whatever it was. But as far as voice goes, my Jessica, Jessica is Jessica. Jessica now has a more modern sensibility in that the world around her is more important to her. And I think when people respond negatively to her voice is she's not, again, and I think I used this word before, she isn't concerned, as she doesn't talk as much about bake sales and minutia. That's the word, minutia.
Mm-hmm.
She is more focused on conflict, because conflict, and I think that's where the voice comes in. People think I've made her too snippy. I don't think I have. People think I've made her too, you know, a little more self-deprecating. Well, she makes fun of herself. I think that's a positive trait. People criticize me for the fact that Mort calls her Jessica instead of Mrs. Fletcher or Mrs. F, which is true to the television show. And that was conscious on my part, because it did not feel real to me that two people who knew each other so well, who had been through so much, would not be on a first name basis. Now, if we're assuming it's 1985, a world without computers, without the internet, without Kindle, without just about so many of the staples of modern day life, without flat screen televisions, well, then it was a more formal time. People did address, even back in 1985, you heard people being a little more respectful. I don't hear a lot of Mr. and Mrs. like compared to back in those days. On the one hand, and on the other hand, again, I'm assuming that Jessica and Mort have now known each other in real time, which I never say what it is, for at least a dozen years or so. Is it credible that he would still say Mrs. Fletcher? I don't find it credible at all. So, when considering her voice, I think it's an evolution. I think people change. I think people evolve. Even though one of the great things about this series is it's not sequential. You can read them in any order. I think there should be a natural progression in how a character reacts to stimulus based on what has already happened. Example: people don't realize, or a lot of people, and you'll know this, John and Jeff, because you've read it. In the James Bond books, Bond evolves or devolves, deconstructs from Casino Royale to the Man with the Golden Gun. He's an entirely different person. He's basically fallen apart by the end. He's not the ruthless killer. He's lost his competence. He's lost his edge. I don't want to take Jessica as far as Fleming took Bond, but I feel that she should make that. There should be an awareness that this is someone who's been through a lot in their life. She's lost her husband. She's been a widow for years. She became a writer pretty much by accident when her nephew submitted her first manuscript to a publisher without her knowing. So there's a lot to Jessica that I thought was yet to be mined. So when people talk about her voice, she is worrying and thinking about things she never worried and thinks and thought about before. But I think the best answer to that question is this, and I sort of hinted at it before. A writer must first and foremost be true to themselves. A writer should never try to do something that doesn't feel natural and organic. That's which is one of my favorite words when it comes to writing. Jessica is very organically. Jessica's voice is what she wants it to be. I don't write her dialogue any more than I write Caitlin Strong's dialogue, my female Texas Ranger. Jessica writes her own dialogue. Harry McGraw writes his own dialogue. I just type it. And I'm not – so if I don't want to say blame – if you want to blame somebody, blame Jessica, blame Harry. No, I'm the person you got to blame. But, you know, it's interesting because there are those critics and the one-star reviews on Amazon. But if you look at Goodreads, it's the exact opposite. If you look at what the same critics who reviewed A Date with Murder are saying about Manuscript for Murder, it's the praise – the cautionary praise, I would say, like yours, John, is off the charts. And I think, if nothing else, I know that I was true to myself and true to this the character that I've inherited. I didn't create her. I inherited her. And, you know, there's going to be evolution. No, and you can tell me. I don't know. I haven't read the Ace Atkins Parker books. Spencer books, I'm sorry. The Spencer books. I don't know how what I've done compares to what he's done with Spencer. I know they're longer again. I know they look a little more detailed again. There's a lot less white on the pages than when Robert Parker was writing the last few, and I think they were down to about 55,000 or 60,000 words or even less. But I will say that Anthony Horowitz in the Bond series has gone back to the roots. His latest book is a prequel to Casino Royale, where before Bond is 007. He's somebody, you know, he's just a guy who is coming up. So it's kind of like what they did with Daniel Craig a few books back in Skyfall. Skyfall.
Yeah, that was
the
out of
first
whack.
One. Yeah, Skyfall.
That was
yeah, it was, but it was the first one when he's,
by
you know,
himself,
but
kind of.
It's kind of a question of again being true to yourself and not being afraid to take ownership of a character, an iconic character. It's a great responsibility. Jessica Fletcher is the most recognizable, arguably the most famous American pop culture, you know, mystery figure detective in history. There is nobody bigger. Everybody knows Murder, She Wrote. Everybody knows Angela Lansbury, Jessica Fletcher. Everybody knows that. It's a great responsibility. And to think that you can please everybody and attract new readers and build on this and build on the past success of the series, it's not realistic. It's not realistic. You cannot, as a writer, you can't please all the people all the time.
I guess I would come out and I respect you for doing all of that. Because you did take a leap and you did it, and that's a very, very hard thing to do. I guess if I'm looking at it from the side, I guess of the one-star reviewers, I would say that I think what they were doing was when it's kind of like when you pick up any book that is in a massive series, Reacher, Cross, you know, any of them, you kind of know what you're going to get, and you can do it with bands and everything else. When you pick up AC/DC, you know what you're picking up because you want that sound. So I think what happens is when people kind of picked up this book, they kind of looked at it and it was like, this is not the Jessica that I know for 47 books, and they were kind of just like, wow, this is much different. And it might be that album or that thing that they might have to read again for them to kind of let it wear on them and say, oh, okay. It's a little different, but it's not that it's bad. It's just not what I was expecting. So when that music group decides to go and say, I'm going to do a bluesier album than a rock, people are like, what the hell are you doing? But it's like, but wait a second. It's actually good music. It's just not what I expected from that band.
I think that is a great analogy. It's a great analogy. I mean, on the other hand, using that music analogy to push it a little further, Bruce Springsteen has done all kinds of different things. He's done acoustic tours. He does the E Street stuff. He does other things. And there are a lot of people who say, I much prefer his E Street, when he's with the E Street Band and Clarence Clemens' nephew and all that stuff. But I love his other things, too. I love his acoustics. I love his show on Broadway, which they're going to be doing, I think, live on Netflix in December.
You know what's something? You know something funny about Springsteen, which I just found out. Do you know on his very first album, he wrote and recorded. He's the writer of the song "Blinded by the Light." made famous by the English band Manfred whatever in 1976.
Manfred Mann.
Manfred Mann. But he's the one who wrote it and recorded it in 73, and it's on his first album. But see, someone else took it and made it a massive hit. But it was still his song. Someone else just took it and made it something different.
That's right. And he did a version of Because the Night, which was Joan, which was, oh my God, mental block. Patti Smith. I think part of being, but again, we no matter how much you talk about it, I didn't set out to do what I did. With Manuscript for Murder, and with, with Murder in Red, which is a little, which gets us back a little more grounded to more of a mystery, less of a thriller, the writing is a function of the story that you've created. And once once Berkeley was, the publisher was all excited about the concept of Manuscript for Murder. This didn't happen in a vacuum. I developed this concept with my editors at Berkeley. So
right.
I think there was an acknowledgement.
They weren't going to publish something that they weren't going to get behind.
No, and they were involved in the development of the concept.
Yeah.
And they understand everything that I've said. But the most important thing, again, and I keep coming back to this, the worst thing any artist can do in any creative mode, but I think storytelling, is try to be something you're not, try to force a round peg into a square hole, try to imitate somebody else's style. Now, we all start off by imitating writers that we love, but the writers that I started off imitating, the Stephen Kings, the David Morells, the Clive Cussler's, the Robert Ludlums, they were all about pace. They were all about conflict. They were all about suspense. I tell people when they come up to me at a book signing, how do I know if I should buy your book? Well, I tell them, open to any page randomly. Just open the book at random or pick your favorite number. Read that one page. And you could do this. I call this the land test. Do this with any writer that you're thinking about buying. Read a random page, not chosen by the writer, but chosen by you just opening the book. If that page hooks you, makes you want to know what came before and what comes after, makes you want to turn the page to see what comes next, that's an author and a book you're going to enjoy. If that page bores you and just doesn't grab you, don't buy the book. So difference, I would say to people, the best way to know the difference between the first 46 books and what I will be doing subsequent to that number is take any one of the other ones, read one page, and then pick up Manuscript for Murder and do the same thing. Every page, every scene, virtually every paragraph in any book I write has some form of conflict. I didn't sit down, in other words, John and Jeff, I didn't sit down and say, wow, I'm going to change Jessica Fletcher. I'm going to make her different. I'm going to do this. I just wrote her again organically. The way I felt her, the way I saw her, the way I, most important, the way I heard her. And by the way, the compliments, are far, far outweigh the negative. Unfortunately, we have become a society that is prisoners of amateur reviews, Yelp, Google, Amazon. Giant corporations are living in fear of somebody giving them one star reviews for ridiculous reasons. Restaurants and hotels, oh my God. I mean, there have been scandals. Yeah, they go crazy. But, it's kind of like what we've done in this society, and not that it's wrong, it is. It is what it is, right?
Yeah.
We have empowered. If you want to, if you want to be a taxi driver, it takes you about an hour to start driving for Uber. Go ahead, go do it. You want any food, you want to order food from 100 restaurants within 5 miles of your house, call Grubhub.
Yep.
And then if you don't like what you got, you leave a bad review. We've empowered people. We've given power to people who never had it before.
And too many abuse it.
And too many abuse it. Too many, I think some people take great pride in the reviews they do on Amazon, and a lot of the people who have not enjoyed some of my, not just my Jessica Fletcher books, there are people who haven't enjoyed my Caitlin Strong books. There are people who haven't enjoyed, you know, some of the other series, my Blaine McCracken books. I want everyone to love me. Everyone wants everyone to, you know.
Oh God,
you know,
don't get into that already.
Yeah, so look, we all want that. But what I want with the Murder, She Wrote series, with a book like Manuscript for Murder, I want people to, you know, I know it's the best book I could have written, featuring Jessica in this story. I know it works on levels on any number of levels, and I think 99% of the people who read the book are going to agree with me, but there's going to be some who don't, and they're probably not going to read any more in the series. I hope and believe that will be compensated for by new people picking up the series again, or people gravitating to the books who only know the television show. And that seems to be where I do the best, John and Jeff. People who have never read any of the other books but are huge fans of the series, so what am I doing? How do I feel if I take the negative reviews to heart? Then I have to take the reviews that say they could hear Jessica's voice from the television show. There was one review that ran recently which said it was like reading Manuscript for Murder was like reading a screenplay of of one of the old episodes. So if you're going to take the bad stuff to heart, you have to take the good stuff to heart too.
I like that. That's good. And I like the idea of doing a Pepsi challenge on one of your books.
There you go.
There's an 80s reference.
Pepsi or Coke. I mean, I'm challenging you out there, you know. If you want to know what – and by the way, that doesn't make me better than Don Bain and his wife, Renee, because they were very, very good writers. It just makes me different. And the difference is I'm not Don Bain, and so if Don Bain's name isn't on the cover anymore, well then people have to know they're buying a John Land book. They're not buying a Don Bain book.
Right. Talk to me a bit about how you write from the female perspective now. You're known for your action books. You know, I'm a big fan, Blaine McCracken, and Eighth Trumpet is my personal favorite of yours.
Vine
but now too. You're writing really strong, great female characters. Jessica, who you inherited, and, of course, Caitlin. Talk a bit about writing female characters.
You know, I've been blessed. I've always been great at role-playing. I've always had I think you could probably put me away in a rubber room. Maybe I'm not crazy. I'm just eccentric, or that great – the great song by Matchbox 20, I'm not crazy, I'm just a little unwell. You know, I think that might be my theme song, in the sense that I have been through many stages in my life as a youth. You know, I was a spy, I was a vampire when I was a little kid. I was many things, and I was always impressionable. If I got hooked on I was hooked on the old soap opera Dark Shadows and Barnabas Collins,
yeah.
And I got hooked on vampires, and I was obsessed with James Bond, and I'd get home from school on Fridays, and I'd put on a sport jacket and a tie and my shoulder holster and my toy gun, and I would be James Bond. Of course, I was 29 years old at this time, so it was a little weird. no, just kidding. Think I've always been a role player. My imagination has always trumped my reality. So writing from a female viewpoint, remember, I've also written from the viewpoint of Palestinians. I've written from the viewpoint of serial killers. I've written from the viewpoint of some pretty badass villains. I'm not them any more than I'm a woman in her 60s or a Texas Ranger in her late 30s. But in my mind, they're real. So it's easy to write anybody when they're so real to you. My agent, my first agent, the great Tony Mendez. I signed with her when she was, I think, 70, and she was my agent until the day she passed away at the age of 92. She once told me something that, and, you know, people say, well, it's the best advice you've ever given, or the best advice that you've ever heard, or the best thing anybody's told you, the most insightful thing. Tony Mendez once told me when I was starting to branch out and do some different things, I wanted to. She said, if you know the characters, you can write anything. That has never left me because I know Jessica Fletcher. I found you were talking about her voice. Her voice, the way I interpreted her voice or what I'm hearing in my head is for some people a little different than what they want to hear. But that's her. That's the way she's real to me. So, Jeff, the answer to your question is a cop-out because if I consciously tried to do what I'm doing, I would never be able to do it. I have to find that spot in my mind, the subconscious, where things happen that I'm not even expecting, where I don't know. I don't outline. I don't make notes most of the time. I'll do a one-page synopsis, like fake catalog copy. And that's all I have when I start a book. Let me give you a specific example. I'm about to hit page 100, which for me is 3 days' work. a little more than that, a week's work. Just about to hit page 100 of Strong from the Heart, the Caitlin Strong book I mentioned before. I didn't know when I started the book that Pancho Villa was going to become a character in the book. Had no idea. You know, I had to have a reason for Caitlin's great-grandfather to be going to this Texas border town where all the children have been kidnapped, have been stolen. For what reason? And the only one who knows the reason, and this guy, this William Ray Strong has come there specifically to transport a prisoner to the county seat. And that prisoner is Pancho Villa. But Pancho Villa is the only one who claims to know what happened to the children. So instead, they team up. I had no idea that was going to happen. And here's the thing about what people, I think, respond the most positively to in Manuscript for Murder. There is a spontaneity in the Murder, She Wrote series now. I've added a spontaneity that comes from the fact that if I don't know what's going to happen next, you can't possibly know what's going to happen next. When I started the book, I did not know what character in the book the real author was going to be. I didn't know. Well, obviously, it becomes a crucial last chapter twist when you find out who the author of the book within the book for Manuscript for Murder, the actual manuscript, who wrote it. So I think by doing that, this goes to your question, Jeff, because the fact that I don't know what's going to happen next means my characters have to show me. That's how I write from a woman's standpoint. I think in the case of Jessica, because she's a widow, something that some people have noticed and made note of is she talks a lot about her late husband now, Frank. She never did that before. It was like he never existed in a lot of books, most of the books. But it's always a factor. And, you know, I was waiting. Let's break a little news now. Because here's the thing about what I want to do with any character that I'm taking on. I want to find stuff that has never been done before. What's the one thing Murder, She Wrote never ever did on television or in the books? All these years, it's been on the air or being public. We're talking about over 30 years it's been out there. But we've never met the young Jessica Fletcher. We've never met her husband, Frank. We've never seen her when they were raising their nephew, Grady. We've never seen her as a substitute English teacher in Appleton, Maine. Might have been different in the book, but I'm pretty sure it's Appleton where she first meets Frank and where she's living when they get married before they move to Cabot Cove, before she moves to Cabot Cove. In A Time for Murder, remember that word time because it has double meaning. This is book 50. Berkeley really wanted to do something special for book 50. Manuscript for Murder is 48. Murder in Red will be 49. So we discussed the concept of introducing a young Jessica for the first time. 20 years earlier, we still don't give her age. She's married to Frank, she's substitute teaching, and there's a murder at the school where she works. She's only just begun to entertain dreams of being a writer, but she's never investigated a crime before. That's only maybe a half at most, but probably about a third of the book. The rest of the book is set in the present in Cabot Cove, where there's a retirement party from one of the teachers that she used to work with. But, of course, the reason they've come to Cabot Cove is because some of those teachers who were there for that retirement party are going to die. They're going to be murdered.
Now,
somehow,
you do know that that's sort of a very loose plot of an episode in the series, right?
I did not know that, but I
yes. So there's an episode in the series. It's around season 3. There's an episode where the football coach of 25, 30 years is retiring at the party, and they have a retirement party. But what it was that it was the guy got out of jail after being incarcerated for a murder that they said he committed 20 years ago. Well, that was prom night at the high school, and it had to do with that night. Then the retirement came 20 years, and the teacher and his students were involved, or how it was involved in back then. So it's a little loose.
I'm going to have to check out that episode because that's
loose.
One I have
yeah,
not
I'm
seen.
I'm going to find. I'm going to give it to you. Because when I first saw like manuscript from her and I started reading it, I was like, oh, this is blending two TV episodes kind of together. The first one was Footnote to Murder, which was in the first season, which is where Hemsley Post had his manuscript, and it was about the Vietnam War, but no one had read it, and the publisher was trying to get it, and Robert Reed was in the episode, and all of a sudden he dies, and the manuscript is lost. And they wanted to try to find, you know, what's in it because no one had read it. They didn't know what it was. Then the other one was the diary one where it was the model or I forget what she was, actress or something, but she kept a diary with very famous people that she had like affairs with, and it was going up for auction, and the guy had commandeered Jessica to say, bid on it. I want you to buy it because I want to destroy it because I don't want people to read it. And people were dying about this book because she got the diary. And Harry McGraw was in that episode because he was there to try to get the diary, too. Because everybody wanted that diary.
The interesting thing in what you just said, to segue back to where we started,
so
you're basically making
I'm making your point.
You're making the point that these books are now very much like the TV series.
They're still there.
It really is. Right there. I mean, I think you're articulating perfectly why so many people who love the series and are just now discovering the books or haven't read many of them previously are finding the same edge, the same voice. So I think the answer is Jessica's voice is more like her voice was in the TV series. The character of Jessica is a little more like she was in the TV series. And because that's what I'm more familiar with. Unfortunately, you just reeled off a bunch of episodes. If I've seen them, I've forgotten them. And the ones I've been rewatching a lot of them, I haven't gotten to those yet because Hallmark hasn't rerun them. I usually watch a couple every week. I just watched again, Murder Takes the Bus.
That's the best one, dude. That's the best one. Season 1, episode 20.
Yes.
I told you
and
that
of course,
one.
The Murder of Sherlock Holmes, which was the pilot.
Yeah, that was the first
co-starring
one.
Arthur Hill. You know, it's interesting. A couple small things.
John, I'm just putting that out there right now. I want to write a mystery with you. I got plot. It's funny that you say because, you know, Shannon and I are working on a cozy series of our own. And the second, and she's working on, our book one is already done with me. She's doing it now. So I'm in book two. And my setting is in a high school, and somebody gets murdered. And I had the plot of what it is, and I actually had to call Doug Lyle about it so he could tell me if it would work or not.
Wow. So, of course, forensics. You talk to a cardiologist about how to kill somebody. So,
I asked him a question to see how it was going to work, and he was like, oh, yeah. He goes, you can do it, and this is how. So I was like, perfecto.
And is it? And you know, and that's the thing. There is.
So you call me, man. You call me. We'll talk.
Yeah, I mean, you know, all this is connected. And you know, Angela Lansbury was not the first choice to play Jessica Fletcher. Can you believe that? You know who the first choice was? Gene Stapleton, who had come off
from Arthur,
Edith Bunker. She was the first choice.
I did see that.
And Angela Lansbury was the second choice. Angela Lansbury owns that role. Octavia Spencer was rumored to be ready to have taken over when CBS wanted to reboot the series, and Octavia Spencer pulled the plug and said, I cannot be Jessica Fletcher. There is only one Jessica Fletcher, and her name is Angela Lansbury.
Imagine if Eric Stoltz was the Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future, because that film was halfway done when they pulled the plug and got Michael J. Fox to come in and fix it.
Tom Selleck is Indiana Jones.
Dirty Harry was written for Frank Sinatra. And Frank looked at it when it was finished and said, I can't do this. You know, he was a big star. He was still a big star in the 1960s. That script was written in the 60s, the original, the late 60s. And when Eastwood got a hold of it and agreed to do it, he brought in John Milius, who had, the greatest screenwriter of the era, who had gone to film school with Lucas and Spielberg and Coppola. And it was basically a full rewrite, but Milius is uncredited on Dirty Harry. But it became Clint Eastwood's movie. But Frank Sinatra was the original choice to play Harry Callahan. I mean, so these things go on forever. But Angela Lansbury, I mean, the reason why you had Chuck Connors, you had Robert Reed, you had some of the biggest TV actors and some even movie actors around at the time, lining up to be on Murder, She Wrote, because they wanted to work with Angela Lansbury. I mentioned Gene O'Neill.
Told me that too.
Yeah, I mentioned Gene O'Neill before. Gene O'Neill in the television series played the librarian who was suffering from multiple sclerosis and was in a wheelchair. Well, the actress who played her, and the name is not Brenda Vaccaro, but it's an actress who reminded me of Brenda Vaccaro, very well known. The reason that character was in the show was because the other show she was working on got canceled and she was going to lose her health benefits. So Angela Lansbury had that character written into Murder, She Wrote, so this actress would not lose her health benefits, which would have been catastrophic to her condition. So that's the kind of person Angela Lansbury is, and she's still that same person. I'm waiting for someone to criticize me, John and Jeff, for finally saying that Jessica is 5'8.5". On the television show, Angela Lansbury towers over Tom Bosley and so many of the other co-stars. Well, you know what? I made Jessica 5'8.5" because that's how tall Angela Lansbury is. So she might have lost a few inches now that she's 92. But the fact is, this is Angela Lansbury that I'm writing. But she's my co-writer. She's on the cover of every book. The same little picture of her. So to me, what you just said about my inadvertently plagiarizing a couple of the television shows tells me that my instincts, I'm not saying they're right or wrong, but at least they're on point. At least what I'm succeeding in what I'm consciously trying to do with the character of Jessica Fletcher. That means a lot to me.
And one quick comment about A Footnote to Murder, and I'll see if you know this trivia question. Who made their first appearance in that episode that ended up becoming a main character later?
Wow, I'm going to say it was Ron Massick, because he played another character before he played Mort Metzger. Am I right or wrong?
Correct. That was his first appearance, and he played in another one. He was a lieutenant in the New York Police Department, which I always wondered, why didn't they just keep that name, since he had already been in there and he had already been in New York and he was already a cop? I never understood why they didn't just keep it.
You know, that's a very good question. And
I never understood, because he was already in the show.
Well, there were different writers. Levinson and Link, I don't know when their involvement, because they also wrote Columbo in the same era.
Well, Metzger came in season five is when Metzger came in. So first four were all Amos Tupper.
Yep. And Metzger came in and didn't do nearly as many episodes relative to what, because they moved the show to New York for a while, right? They moved it back to Cabot Cove.
And then she was in all over the world.
Yeah, and I don't think I think you're getting on to something very important here. The definition of what makes my books still qualify as cozies in my mind is that it's the same familiarity. It's like visiting old friends. You're still in Cabot Cove. Every one of the books I do is either set almost entirely in Cabot Cove or at least somewhat in Cabot Cove. Because that's what people love. You have the recurring cast of characters. You have, and in Murder in Red, I'm bringing in one of the favorite co-stars from the book series, Chief Inspector Sutherland, is coming in to a key role in that book, which is, so I say that I'm using the mythology of the TV show, but I think it's important to also keep respect and reverence for the 46 books in the series. You know, here's some interesting trivia. There were only 21 Sherlock Holmes novels and 7 novelists, I believe.
Yeah,
there were only 28 Hercule Poirot novels written by Agatha Christie. There have been others written by other people since then. There were 83 or 88 Perry Masons. So there were an awful lot of Perry Masons. But it's very rare, especially in this day and age, that a series reaches 46 books before I even got involved. So give a lot of credit to Don and Renee Bain for what they did. Because this is such an enduring series. It's so part of American pop culture in that it's multi-generational. So many people have written me and said, reading this book reminded me of sitting on the couch as a little girl watching Murder, She Wrote with my mother or grandmother or family. Because in those days, no VCRs, no DVR, no TiVo. You watched it or you didn't see it. It's like, I'll date myself, John, maybe you'll remember this, but I can remember Friday nights back in the 80s, you were home at 9 o'clock to watch Miami Vice. I don't care where you were, you went home, because you had to see what was the music going to be, what were they going to be wearing, what Armani sport jacket was Don Johnson going to trash over his $1,000 sport coat over the $2 T-shirt and the sandals and the pajama pants. Which I still wear, by the way. I've never gotten out of Miami Vice era.
You want to know something funny? My number one show back then, though, was Dallas. Sorry. I'm even dating myself.
Seriously?
Dallas was it, man. I loved them all. And then that season when Patrick Duffy came back and she sees him in the shower and that whole fucking season was a dream, you got to admit, I was pissed to the hilt.
You know, what we're witnessing today with the explosion of quality television.
Exactly.
I mean, the quality television, when you look at Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad and Sopranos, we can go on forever. But there's a precedent for this. Go back to that era, John, and think about Heck Ramsey. Think about Quincy. Heck Ramsey was, Forensic Investigation, played by Richard Boone playing an older paladin is essentially what that show was. Quincy was Jack Klugman coming off The Odd Couple as a coroner. No one had ever done that before. No one had ever said a series about forensic. It was CSI without DNA. That's how great Quincy was. Rockford Files with James Garner. The classic nature of television in the 80s. Murder, She Wrote.
Do you think Ironside was better than Perry Mason?
It wasn't as iconic. No, I'm going to say no because.
But I didn't say iconic. I just said, do you think it was better?
No, because you have to consider everything as a whole. And Hamilton Berger's character, Paul Drake's character, the cop. There was the same thing. I think Perry Mason resembles Murder, She Wrote more than any other mystery series because of the number of recurring characters that people came to want to see. From episode to episode, book to book, I used to love Perry Mason. I used to watch him. He was on every day at 4 o'clock. So many days I'd watch him, but I didn't like the episodes that didn't have Hamilton Berger as he got sick. He had lung cancer. He cut way back. But I always liked Paul Drake, the Private Eye, and Raymond Burr. And again, right down to I think it was Nelson Riddle who wrote the Perry Mason theme. He wrote Peter Gunn. He wrote The Untouchables. He pretty much wrote every TV, all those great TV themes. But everything about that show, from the introduction to the closeout to the fade-out to Raymond Burr. You knew in the end he was going to solve it, but you had a group of characters. The same thing in the Rockford Files. There was a comfort because you wanted to see Rocky. You wanted to see the Louis Gossett Jr. character in his recurring roles. Kojak did this with Roosevelt's career.
Kojak.
So I think
Here's a question for you two then.
Yes.
Perry Mason or Matlock?
Perry Mason.
Perry Mason.
So
not even close.
Do you do you ever think that there will ever be a character that plays a role like that that will ever be stronger than a Perry Mason? Is it impossible to do?
It's a great question. And they tried to do that with Judd for the Defense around the same time by creating the anti Perry Mason, and it worked for about a season, and that was the end. I think you could make the answer is it would have to be different because times are so different. You could make the argument that Michael Connelly's Lincoln Lawyer books are the Perry Mason of this era. You could make the same argument about Dismiss Hardy and the great John LeSquaw books. You could make that argument. I don't think you could make it about Grisham because he doesn't have any – I don't know if any of his characters have recurred the way Dismiss Hardy recurs and the way some of these other lawyer characters have recurred. So I think that Raymond Burr, I mean, he was born to play that role. I mean, that he became Ironside too, but he was born to play Perry Mason.
Well, let me ask a question that ties into this. Speaking of television, I've heard that Angela Lansbury, who is in her 90s, would love to do one more Jessica Fletcher. And I'm wondering if we might actually see that, or with yourself, will we see Caitlin on the small screen?
Well, let me answer the first question first. The idea for A Time for Murder, book 50, actually started when I said, "What if I write a story about a younger Angela Lansbury, so another actress is playing her in the past, then she would only have to work half the time. And it would be a lot less taxing than working a full two-hour TV movie, even though they're only approximately 88 minutes long. So that's kind of what I was thinking. And in addition to giving new life to the series, if you rebooted it with a younger Jessica Fletcher before she's found fame and fortune, that would be the way you could. Now, Caitlin, I got to tell you, I mean, timing is everything. We started this conversation by talking about Stephen Hunter and Shooter, Bob Lee Swagger, being played by Ryan Phillippe on USA. I just haven't found the right fit in this. Not that I haven't been looking, but getting something on the air requires perfect timing. You need to get it in someone's hands at the exact moment they're looking for what you're giving them. And even then, you have to be very lucky that they find the right casting and they find the right director. And then they make a great pilot that gets on the air. Caitlin has been close several times. And as you know, she was knocked off Sony, which could have been CBS, by Killer Women, which was a rival female Texas Rangers show. Now, James Patterson has a Texas Rangers show coming on, but he's not a Texas Ranger anymore. He's a Florida homicide detective who used to be a Texas Ranger. So I think that I have to be patient, and I have to when the mortgage company asks me why I'm late with my mortgage, I tell them, wait, be patient. Caitlin Strong's going to get on television someday, and then I'm going to pay off the whole mortgage in one check. So they don't like to listen to that, but they don't get it. But I honestly believe that. I do think Caitlin Strong will have her day. And it's just, it'll happen when I'm least expecting it. It'll happen in the craziest set of circumstances.
I like that.
Interesting. So here's one question. I'm gonna see if I can get you on a trivia question on Murder, She Wrote. Are you ready?
Yeah.
I believe I'm right.
Okay.
So I believe I'm right. But who is the first character in the series to be a cop and a murderer in the same episode? And it'll tie in, if you think of the character, why I'm asking it.
Wow. I would be guessing because I can't remember the episode, or if I've seen it, it's not coming into my mine right now. I'm going to draw. I'm going to give you that one and say what I'm one out of two. Who was it?
Okay, Jeff, do you know?
I don't.
Okay, so it was Ken Howard, and it was Murder at the Oasis, and he was the cop that also killed Johnny, I forget his name, but he was like the mobster, and he killed him because he was the hitman for the other mobster, but he ended up becoming the cop in that town and killing him. And the reason I said Ken Howard is because he is a character like Dennis Stanton that shows up later as a detective without Jessica in the episode having to solve the case. And Dennis Stanton does the same thing, too, in some episodes that she wasn't in. So that's why I brought that up.
When she was produced, that's an excellent one. Was that the one that opens at the racetrack? The one with
Murder
Ken
at
Howard?
The Oasis? No, Murder at the Oasis is where she goes to meet her friend. And it actually was filmed at the Calabasas Country Club. She goes to meet her friend, and her friend ex-husband is the mobster. And she goes to meet with her, and then he ends up dying.
In a restaurant. Okay, this one, you know what? This is next up in my queue. I think I've seen the first 5 minutes of that one. It sounds very familiar because there weren't that many ones that used the mob as a backdrop.
No.
Which is strange because the mob
in
the Boston mob in the 80s, you know, Whitey Bulger.
Well, they used that same premise twice in the same series because in the one that says we're off to kill the wizard, the guy was killed behind his locked office door. And in this one, the guy was killed behind his locked lounge door. So it was the same premise, like how did somebody get in and out of there because it was a locked door? So,
but it wasn't a gorilla coming down the chimney like in Murders in the Rue Morgue.
No, it was not that. So it was like those and those. And so, you know, I just thought that, you know, I just love Murder, She Wrote. And I love the trivia and I love the episodes. I love them all. You know, the one thing that I have to say, too, is, you know, in the first season, it was not Seth Hazlitt. He was not around. He wasn't even mentioned. It was the other guy, the fisherman.
Claude Akins.
Yes, he was in the first episode. I liked him a lot.
He was a great character.
His name was Ethan. Ethan.
Yes, the fisher, yes. And played by the big...
I loved him.
Yeah, he was an excellent character, and I don't know why he didn't make it past season two, I think.
He didn't make it into season two. He was only in season one.
I didn't know that Seth Hazlitt was not in season one because I don't know when I'm watching these episodes. I don't know what season they come from. So that's William Wyndham.
Well, which one are you on? Oh, wait a second. One at the racetrack. That's season two. That's Dead Heat. That's where her niece is a jockey.
That's right. Okay.
So that's the season one. Two.
I think I'm getting that one confused with the mob one, which opens at you said Country Club. I'm remembering more of a New York kind of speakeasy, but they could be. There are so many of them. Let's face it. There were so many over 12 years. There were 240 episodes.
Yeah, 200 and
pretty soon there are going to be that many books.
Yeah, 264 episodes, but then there's still, you know, like seven movies. So let's hope, you know, I don't know though. 92 years old. I hope she could still do it, but I just don't know what. I don't know what it would be. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think maybe she should just be done. I think it was great the way it was. I think some of those movies were, you know, later when she was doing it, she just seemed too frail to be doing that work anymore.
Interesting.
You know, she wasn't.
Interesting.
You know, yeah, I don't know. She wasn't, because, you know, when you see Jessica Strong, like I said, I always like to go back to the first series when she was in Washington and she had to take the place and she was the representative. She was really, like, strong. And you could just see. Strong.
Almost sounds like, you know, it sounds like the way I'm writing her, doesn't it? You know?
I know. She was.
Excellent.
She was strong. She was decisive. She, you know, she looked these people dead in the eye and said, I'm voting no on this bill because it's not good for my community, and boom, boom, boom. And then people gave her a standing ovation. But she stood up for what she wanted all the time.
So when people criticize Manuscript for Murder for the White House scenes and the fact that that it gets political, again, I don't think they're being 100% fair to the spirit of the series because that was Jessica in the TV show. So again, you know, I think we've come, if not, I think we've established some clarity about where I've gone right with the series and where arguably I've gone wrong with it. You know, I think that if Angela Lansbury read my books, read my take on Jessica, I think she would love them. I think she would say, he's got it the way it was. And if I ever got that opportunity to, you know, to get a book to her, that would be about the greatest compliment I could possibly be given as a writer.
I hope you could do that. Real quick question, because we're already out of time, and it's been awesome.
That's why it's a quick question, because we're out of time.
Why do you think she has remained so popular all these years?
Ooh, that's a good one.
That's a great question. And I think it's the reason why, because Jessica Fletcher, in whatever way you see her, is always Jessica Fletcher. She doesn't age. She stays the same. It's kind of like that, you know, it's kind of like the feeling you get when you're pulling to the driveway for Thanksgiving and you're going to walk in and see old friends and family you haven't seen in a while. Jessica Fletcher is everyone's aunt. Jessica Fletcher is part of American pop culture. In a time where American pop culture was coming out of Vietnam, coming out of the 70s gave us some of the most violent movies ever made. If you look at, you know, the Sam Peckinpah, which is also the late 60s, Dirty Harry, Deliverance, powerful films in which violence and the R-rated movie became mainstream. I think Jessica Fletcher's popularity and her enduring popularity is due to the fact that she brings us back to a time that was to a different kind of time, that she stood out in the sense that, you know, she was different than Miami Vice, even though they were on the air at the same time, and she lasted a lot longer. She represented all the best things that remind you of home, the familiar sense, the fact that you do for others more than you do for yourself, that Jessica Fletcher is the kind of person that you could call at 3 o'clock in the morning if you had a flat tire, and she'd come out wherever she was. However tired she would find a way to get there, even though she doesn't drive. So she would wake somebody up, and she would get there to help you. I think that's why America welcomed her into their homes on Sunday nights for as long as they did. They did the same thing with Bonanza. And I think many of the things people loved about Bonanza for the 20 years it ran on Sunday nights is what they loved about Murder, She Wrote. When you think about Murder, She Wrote, like I said before, you think about not just watching it, but who you watched it with, where you were at the time, what you did that day, and what you did the next day. It wasn't just a diversion. It was a part of your life in a way that very few television shows. But you want to know something? Game of Thrones is debuting. The final season debuts in April of 2019. 6 episodes, all approximately 75 to 90 minutes long. People, I'm not going to DVR. I'll DVR it in case I miss something, but I'm going to be at 9 o'clock those nights. I'm going to be down there watching it. So I think when you start talking about what makes Game of Thrones what it is, what made The Walking Dead before it fell apart when it was an iconic television show, why 30 million people watch that for different reasons, of course. There's something that resonates with these shows that become part of the staple that become staples of pop culture, that resonate with us in ways that we can't really articulate. But I think with Murder, She Wrote and Bonanza, Gunsmoke, it's seeing old friends. And when you see those old friends every Sunday night at a certain time, you know, it makes you feel, you know, you're in their world. You're not in your world anymore.
Right.
So I it's kind of a long answer to the question. But I think that's really what it is.
I like that. And the sad thing is, I know this, Bonanza ran 14 years and Gunsmoke was the 20.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
and Law and Order was 22. The original Law and Order
Law and Order, the original
years.
Law and Order beat it, yeah.
Well,
it beat out Gunsmoke.
So. You know,
well, they tied.
You know, And just to elaborate a little, because why do I love Jessica Fletcher so much is because she's not controversial. Every decision she makes is a decision that everybody else would make, and you're not sitting there going, oh, God, why did you doing that? She's not going to pull out a gun. Everything is done with her mind. You know, there's no internet. There's nothing that she can do electronically to just find the mystery. You're like, when you're watching a CSI, you're watching the characters and you're waiting for them to solve the mystery. You have nothing else but just to see how electronically, you know, they're going to do it, and the little girl at the end of the computer is going to say, oh, they're right there, and then everybody's going to be fazed. So you're just going to see how they do it. But with Jessica,
you know,
you're doing it with her.
But you just made such a wonderful point, John. And that is what you've raised is the fact that my books and Don Bain's books, to a slightly lesser degree, because, you know, he wasn't relying as much on technology. I brought Jessica into the 21st century, and that includes DNA and everything else. So it's still Jessica, but now she has more tools at her disposal. She is able to utilize technology, but she's not an expert in these things. Look, she typed her first God knows how many books on a Royal typewriter, not an Olivetti.
Right.
And then she got a Windows computer, and then she got an Apple, a Mac computer.
And she was scared to death to use it. So.
Yeah, and then she never got a driver's license. You know, never saw the.
Right.
You know, so, but, she. These books, and let me put it this way, these books are not prisoners of technology the way so many books are, the way so much is, where they become prisoners of technology in the sense that you don't do things that you used to do because now everybody gets caught because they licked a stamp or something like that.
Yeah.
I like to capture the old-fashioned feel, and I think Manuscript for Murder does not rely on forensics. A Date with Murder did not rely on forensics, although
we did get into
computers. Murder in Red, she's doing legwork the old-fashioned way. Her powers of observation are stronger than any DNA test, to your point.
Right.
When does that come out?
Murder in Red will come out May 28th.
Nice.
The last Tuesday in May and the first Tuesday in November, that's when my two Murder, She Wrote books come out every year.
But now, when does it come out for people like me?
As soon – Murder in Red, I you know what? Do I have – I don't have a galley yet. But any day you'll have – any day.
Ooh. Yeah.
any day.
Okay. But
– I just sent Mark
Aducci. Like I said, she's not controversial. She always makes the right decision, and you always know. And like you said, you know, she'll help you on the heartbeat. In the second episode of the series, people, she goes and she helps a total stranger who's clipping her hedges into her house. It happened to be, of course, the dad that ends up getting killed of the three girls that were off the boat and whatnot. But she doesn't know this guy from whatever, and she gives him her husband's pipe.
Wow.
It's like
she does the same thing. She gives an old bicycle to a boy who's being raised by a single mother.
Yes.
In another terrific
episode.
Who
was being accused of murder.
Yes, exactly. Falsely, because she was – that was actually a really good episode, too.
That was. That showed a lot of emotion because it showed, you know, Amos Tupper kind of had a soft side for stuff like that.
Yes,
and
yes. He becomes a father figure to the boy, Tom Bosley.
Throwing a football to the kid.
You know,
and elaborating like anybody was, you know, winning the state championship, and Jessica's like, oh, yeah, I remember that, you know, kind of like covering for
Well, you know, I like that, and I love, like, in Manuscript for Murder, you find out that Mort Metzger fought in Vietnam. It was never revealed. It was never revealed before.
I forgot that.
I take it back. Was it murder? No, it was Manuscript for Murder. It's just that as an aside. But, you know, people also criticized me. There was one strange thing that said, Mort and Jessica aren't the same age, aren't close to the same age. Well, wait a minute. Mort Metzger had a full career in New York as a cop. So he's likely in his late 50s. when he comes to or he was in his early 50s when he first got to Cabot Cove.
Yeah, back that time in like 1989, he would have retired around 57, 58, had 30 years in the force.
So he is about Jessica's age. He is about the same age, but he's also, now that I'm putting him in his probably his mid 60s, he was in Vietnam, and she didn't know about that. So it's fun when you have a series which has been on for so long and we're still learning things about the characters.
Yeah, because people got to remember, too, from the series, from Sherlock Holmes to Deadly Lady, she had already written more other bestsellers. So from the first episode to the second, it wasn't like she still only had The Corpse Danced at Midnight out. She was already writing other books. She had already written other ones. So it had to be 2-3 years in the future from her first book.
Great.
Because you can't write three freaking books in a year.
That's a great – well, I don't say that because –
but a royal typewriter. I mean, you can't do that. So, you know, I mean, think about that. So she already had Corpse Dance at Midnight out on the Sherlock Holmes one. But when Deadly Lady comes and she's writing, that's not her second manuscript because they talk about her being, you know, how she's already written other books and to go in and sign stuff. So it's like, come on. It had to be 2 or 3 years after that.
Absolutely. And that's the whole – but there's nothing wrong with that. That's kind of – that's a cheat you can do in this industry in the sense that, you know, if Jessica never ages –
you
got
to suspend disbelief because at
right.
the end of season 5, she's already written like 25 bestsellers because that other woman is trying to kill her, you know, that other mystery writer who knocked out of number one for like her whole life, and Jessica's now number one with like 20 books in. So that had to be like 20 years, but she doesn't age 20 years.
By the way, I've also been criticized for making her number one best-selling author. Well, you just
reminded
people that she is a number one best-selling author because that's not necessarily the way she was portrayed in the books. And
she's the queen of mystery almost.
Yep, and that's, you know, and she's a very fun character to write. And I don't know why I've taken to her so naturally. But, you know, I'm really looking forward to doing a Time for Murder because I don't know what she was like 20 years ago. But I'm going to have a lot of fun finding out. And I'm going to have a lot of fun having her stumble into her first investigation. And we start to see her interacting with Frank,
If you want some help, there are some episodes where she does talk about her past and stuff like that. I can point you in the direction to watch them, so let me know.
I know, yeah, there was that great episode that set in the theater that goes back to Appleton where she meets old friends who apologize for not coming for Frank's funeral. And she
you actually hear her meet him for the first time, too.
In the background, you hear, yes, you hear his voice. But
he goes, "Hi, I'm Frank Fletcher." And she goes, "Hi, I'm Jessica." Fuck, what's her maiden name?
McGill. Jessica McGill.
McGill, because they're working on the set of that play. That's what they were doing.
Absolutely,
so.
Yes. That was a really good episode.
Yeah. But you also,
that was
the Dixie Damsel, remember in the Dixie Damsel, he's in the military and she's working as a substitute teacher with him in the military because he was flying a plane that they didn't think was going to make it and he almost died in a plane crash. And they talk about that one, too.
Wow. And there's another story I did not know.
Yeah, the Dixie Damsel, because that's his friends, and they all know, because then the plane comes in, and they find it out of the – in Alaska, it was, like, revealed out of the snow, whatever, where it went down. But then when they get the plane back to the Air Force base, there's a dead body on the plane. So now they're trying to figure out who did it. So all of the pilots have to – or the people who are on that plane come back, all Frank's friends that were on that plane – and then they're trying to say, well, if you didn't do it, you didn't do it, you didn't do it. So then they're trying to say Frank killed the guy. So Jessica had to solve a 20-year-old murder that she wasn't even around in.
I have to check that one out.
Mm-hmm. And
Hallmark doesn't show them right now because of all the Christmas movies.
But that's her second love
interest. I know they're off for a while.
Yeah.
Because the Dixie Damsel, the next episode, she goes away with one of Frank's friends, and he tries to marry her and get her to stay with him in New Mexico or something. So that's her second love interest. But bam!
Wow!
Don't you test me on this shit!
You're good.
So, well, hey, man.
You're good.
We've been running over. But this was great. I love it. I could keep going. But the show is going to have to end here in about 10 minutes. So. Yeah. But I could. I mean, I could keep going because this is the part. This is why I love the show so much, is because this is what it does to you. It draws you in with all these things and all this stuff going all over the place. And like I've told you before, Seth Hazlett does not own a house in Cabot Cove. He's a renter. Check out season 5, Indian Giver. He tells you he rents the house. So
you know what? I'm going to start sending you all my manuscripts. Never mind waiting for the galleys.
I'm telling you. You know, Benedict Arnold slipped here. That was another good one, too. Because then you got the house that Benedict Arnold was in, and you got the murder that happened in that one. And there was some cool little backstory things that happened in that episode too. So, yep.
Wow.
You know, and you got into the John Astin ones, right? The guy who played under John Astin. The
yes,
Adam.
He was a real
guy.
Estate developer who becomes sheriff for one episode.
And what does he do? Bam. Yep. Yep. But he was a real estate developer in like other episodes before that,
yes.
And then all of a sudden they did that to him, yeah, because you thought Amos Tupper was going to retire. And
yeah,
that episode right there was based off of a real-life story in Circleville, Ohio, called the Circleville Letter Writer. Look that up.
Wow.
It's the number one mystery still in Ohio. Still no one knows who mailed all these letters. And all these letters were mailed all around town in Circleville, and somebody died. And somebody got killed, and there was a big mystery about, and they don't know if it was the same person or whatnot, but then they took that premise, and then they made that episode in Murder, She Wrote. So, yeah. So,
wow.
Man, I'm a freaking
wow.
Encyclopedia knowledge, and I don't
You're
even...
You're humbling me, because, you know, it's kind of like, one of my dreams has always been, a lot less so now, was always to write, you know, a James Bond screenplay. But I would write them the way Sean Connery played them. Because that's those were the ones I grew up on. And it,
we had that
Murder,
argument
wrote,
already once.
Oh, did we? Okay. But anyway,
I'm Roger Moore. Yeah.
Oh my God. Well, we won't talk about that tonight.
No, we don't have enough fucking time.
But you know, it's. I think I've taken over. It, ironically, in many ways, I've taken over a series that's equally iconic to Bond, in a different way, but it comes with its own set of responsibilities. So that's what I need to keep in mind. I always have to keep the humility has to always be there, that this is bigger, that I have a tremendous responsibility to uphold the tradition that we've just talked about for the last half hour, just quoting individual episodes that have been off the air for 25 years. It's a show that's been off the air for 25 years, and we're talking about individual episodes and their guest stars. That's quite a mantle to inherit, and I'm not always, it's something I always have to be cognizant of. But that said, I've got to be true to the Jessica that as I see her. I can't try to write her as something that's not natural.
Cool.
But that's okay,
and that's her.
She will always be mine. She's mine now, but she isn't. So it's kind of like I'm, But that's all right, Also, it's truly a pleasure.
Oh,
well, definitely
done.
Are looking forward to the next one and the next one after that too. So.
Yeah.
Oh,
great.
Yeah.
Hey.
Well,
and you know
we'll
what? It's
going to
be great because we're all three going to be together at Thriller Fest in July this year. So that's going to be good. I saw Jeff last year, but I haven't seen you, John. And this will be be 4 years now when we come back. So looking forward to it.
Well, I'm looking forward. We're all looking forward to having you there because it's a lot more
fun. We
got to
go. You, me, Shannon, Jeff, we got to go out and go to dinner or something and just kind of just relax it out because there's always so busy time. We got to take time to carve it and just do it with us.
Oh, 100% agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, John.
This was great.
Always.
I had a blast.
Always. No other interview will top this one.
We just ruined
it for everyone else.
That's bold. That's a bold statement, John.
I'm there. You ain't going to have any more fun anyplace else than right here.
That's
you just
sure.
did right here.
Yeah, yeah.
Come on.
It's, your mouth, and I'll be fine with that.
That's awesome. Well, we'll have to have you back on when the next one comes out, too.
Sounds like a plan.
Yeah. All right, man. You have a good one, and stay safe. I hope the snow doesn't, pile up on you guys, but just get that dusting.
That's all right. We'll be fine.
And
all
get
right.
some sleep. Good grief, if it's almost midnight your time.
Yeah, God, it's sorry we kept you up.
believe me, you're not. I haven't been to bed before midnight in 20 years.
Oh, shit. All right. Well, hopefully you sleep until 11. So, yeah.
That's
all right,
right,
man. You have
all
a good
right.
one. We'll talk to you later.
Take care.
Take care.
All right, bye. Hey, Jeff. So, man, that was one of the best. Come on.
Love John. Love his stuff. Very exciting and awesome. Thanks.
Yeah. Because, and I think that we did right. And I'm glad that he kind of got out in front of it and kind of said this is what he was doing. Because I think people hopefully will listen to this and, understand, this is what he did. Because when I first read it, I was one of those guys. Like I said, I picked up the AC/DC album. I wanted to hear AC/DC. And instead I was like, what am I hearing? This is not, this is like me going from Injustice for All to the Black album, Metallica. And I'm like, what happened to my Metallica? This is not really the same. And so, but then after a while you listen to it, you're like, oh, you know what? This is a really good album. It's just, I didn't expect it to be a Metallica album, but it's a good album. And that's why I made that analogy.
No, and that was a great analogy. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, man. So when will we be back? Are we going to be back in 2 weeks?
I think so. And then we're taking the holiday, right?
Yeah, then we're taking December off. So our last show of the year is in 2 weeks. So I don't know. Maybe we won't have any guests, and we'll just kind of do, year in review of, books and any kind of movies and things, because then it's, Christmas time, and, you got DVDs coming out. Maybe we'll just do something like that.
Well, it sounds like fun. Let's see what we can do.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of good stuff that came out this year, and maybe people are looking for DVDs or recommendations. And I know that we'll have a little better idea of our best of selections around that time. So,
oh, good.
Maybe
good.
We'll
yeah,
drop a hint here and there and see what goes on for the big December issue that we put out for our best of, and see who's our Crimson Scribe Award winner this year. Who knows?
So. Yeah, all right.
All right. All right, man. Well, you have a good one. We'll talk to you later. And I'm so happy that you are back from your vacation, happy and healthy and rocking and rolling. That's good.
All right. Well, thanks. And stay safe out there, okay?
Yeah. So far, so good. Fingers crossed that we just got to get the wind to die down and get a little rain, and we'll be good to go out here in California. So.
Cool.
All right. Until next time, everybody. Keep reading.
Good night.